How many of you remember this scene?
Dr. Grant, my dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
If you're a fan of the Jurassic Park movies, you know that that's the scene from the original 1993 Jurassic Park film where the two scientists, Dr. Alan Grant and Dr. Elie Sattler, see the dinosaurs for the first time. And the reason why I bring that up is that scene summarizes my experience of going on safari in Tanzania. I mean, everywhere I looked, there was these majestic animals that I'd never seen before, and it just reminded me so much of that scene from Jurassic Park. So I've written up an article on my website to summarize my trip, but I thought I'd also put it in podcast form for all those of you who want to listen to a little bit more details about my recent trip to Africa. So let me first start off with why I decided to go to Africa. For a few years now, as I get a bit older, I've gone on a trip to a new location every year on my birthday. It kind of makes getting older a little bit easier when you have something to look forward to. But typically when I choose to go on holiday, I kind of like to go to places that I've already been before, Europe being one of my favorites. I usually go to a different part of Europe. But every year on my birthday, what I try to do is go to some place that I've never been to before. And I usually go for a relatively short period of time. I go for like 3 or 4 days to a country that I think I may not normally go to, but would be kind of interesting. And last year, for example, I went to Moscow, which turned out to be absolutely fantastic. I never thought I would go to Russia. I didn't know anything about it. All I knew about Russia was what I'd seen in movies in the 80s, and turned out to be completely different than what I expected. And actually, I might do a podcast on my Russia trip as well, because it was so different than what I thought. So last year I went to Russia and it was awesome. And so this year I was trying to think about where to go when I came across this post on Reddit. And for those of you who don't know, Reddit is an internet website where people can post like tons of different things. And you have all these different subreddits, subcategories where people post stuff. And this one particular post was in the travel section. And this guy had posted pictures of his trip to Tanzania. And when I saw his pictures, I always in the back of my mind wanted to go to Africa. But I think maybe for a lot of others as well, it's always one of those trips that you think you'll do later. Like to me, it seems like it's either a honeymoon trip or a retirement trip. And so it always was something that I thought I would do later. But when I saw this guy's photos, it kind of sparked that interest. My birthday was coming up. I was actually debating on whether to go to Romania or not. I think I might try to do that next year. But when I started to look into it, I realized that it wasn't actually as expensive as I thought it would be. And I thought it would be kind of a fun trip to do, considering next year I'll be leaving Japan, heading back to Canada, and I don't know what my schedule will be like back in Canada. So right now my schedule is fairly flexible. I thought this would be a great time to head out and visit Africa. So the first thing obviously you have to do when you decide to go to Africa is figure out where you want to go and what you want to see and which country you want to visit. And I think a lot of people, myself included, when we think of Africa, I kind of tend to lump the whole continent together. And whatever I see on the news, no matter what country in Africa it is, I kind of think that that's all of Africa. But obviously that's not correct. And I read some articles about Tanzania in the fact that two things really struck with me was that Tanzania has a fairly stable government, a democratically elected government. Certainly they're a poor country, but I like the fact that they're politically stable. And two is the fact that they have national parks set aside equivalent to the size of Germany. And so I thought, well, that's pretty cool. That's a lot of space there they've got put aside. So I decided to go to Tanzania. And when I researched it, I realized a lot of people obviously want to go on the Serengeti. Many people go to Kenya. But if you look at the Serengeti, over 80% of it is actually in Tanzania. So that's where I chose there. So I chose Tanzania. And unfortunately for me, my birthday is in July, which doesn't really make it a great time to travel because it's usually the peak of travel season with everything's expensive and it's usually hot wherever I'm going. But I mean, what can I do? It's my birthday. So I decided to go there, and then I had to look for a guide. I had to look for a tour company. Now, initially, I thought I would kind of book everything separately myself. I'd book the hotel, the lodge, the tour company, all the activities, all that individually online. But it turns out that's actually not the case. The best thing to do is find a tour company, tell them what you want to do, and they will book everything for you. And finding a tour company is not easy because there's over 300 of them operating in the Serengeti area. And it's really hard to get an idea of the quality of the tour operator based on their website. Because on the website, anyone can say anything. And so you really are kind of at a disadvantage to find a really great tour company. For me, what I did was I emailed the guy who had posted the photos on Reddit. And I asked him who he used because I obviously liked the areas that he went to and the animals he saw. So he recommended Everlasting Tanzania as the tour company. I read a bunch of their reviews online. Everything seemed positive. So I emailed them and the owner, Rob, contacted me back and we arranged for a Skype call. And that's where I could give him the details of what I was looking for. And one of the first things I told Rob, besides like the dates and kind of the animals I wanted to see, is one of the first things I told him, as I said, you know, I'm coming as a solo traveler this time. I asked him if there was a solo supplement, an extra charge on that. He said no, which was great. But I told him, one of the things I told him was, I said, listen, I live in Tokyo. The city is ridiculously crowded. You can never get away from the people here. Everywhere you go, no matter what time of the day, what time of the week, there's always a million Japanese, you know, going the same direction. I don't know what they're doing, but they're always going somewhere. So I said, I want to experience like complete emptiness. And so he put this itinerary together where I would avoid a lot of the crowds and the regular tour groups that were being that were going around at that time. So that was really great. So he first thing he did was set the itinerary, what areas of the Serengeti we're going to go see. I told him some of the animals that I wanted to see. I didn't really have any concerns about that, to be honest. I'm interested in seeing anything that's there. And then the second thing was my budget. He asked me what level of comfort would I be interested in? Do I want to stay in a lodge? There's actually a Four Seasons hotel, like right smack dab in the middle of the Serengeti, which is kind of cool. Or do I want to stay in a camp? And I didn't really want to stay in a lodge because I felt like if I'm going to Africa and I'm going to a safari, I don't want to stay in a hotel because I can stay in a hotel anywhere in the world. So I don't really want to stay in a hotel. But at the same time, when he said camp, my idea of camping coming from Canada is literally like a dome tent in the middle of the forest, and your toilet facilities are a shovel and toilet paper. And so I said, well, I don't really want to camp, but I don't really want to stay in a hotel either. But then he laughed and sent me some links that showed me that these camps in Africa are unbelievable. I mean, it's hard to describe, but they're not the little dome tent in the middle of Africa. They're like a what would you call these things? Like an army tent. If you ever seen that old TV show MASH. You know, they got the big army tents and anyways, they're big. I mean, literally one of the tents I stayed in was bigger than my apartment in Tokyo. So he said, no, this is what we call camping in Africa. And the camps were just absolutely amazing. So I set everything up. I let Rob set everything up. A lot of people always ask me how much everything costs. And I gave him a budget of $5,000. That's excluding airfare and anything else that I had to buy. But you could do it cheaper. You could do it more expensive. It's really up to you. I saw people there on kind of on a more of a backpacker's budget who were part of these large tour groups that were going around the Serengeti, these massive buses with like 20, 30 people inside. That's certainly a lot cheaper. There were people there who were staying at like the Four Seasons and they were on the private Four Seasons safari. Which I'm sure was a lot more than I was paying. So it really depends on, I think there's a lot of options depending on what your budget is. So I gave Rob my budget of $5,000 and I said, this is the minimum level of comfort that I want. I didn't really care if the hotels, the camps had Wi-Fi or not. Some of them had Wi-Fi and I said, no, I don't really want that. I actually wanted to disconnect completely for the whole time I was there. But I said, I definitely want like ensuite toilets and a nice comfortable bed and all that kind of stuff. And so he put this itinerary together and it was absolutely fantastic. I couldn't have planned that myself. All the areas that we went to, I mean, I had no idea. It's hard to research that online. So my suggestion is to find a guide is search online, search for the reviews, and try to do as many Skype calls as you can. I was really lucky in that Rob turned out to be great. And even better was the tour guide he assigned to me, whose name was Solomon, turned out to be absolutely amazing. I mean, Solomon really made this whole trip. Not only in the fact that he knew everything about the Serengeti. I mean, this guy was just a walking Wikipedia of what was out there. But he really acted as a host to me during the whole time and completely took care of all my needs and all that. So the $5,000 may sound like a lot, but consider the fact that you don't have to spend anything once you're there. Once I land at the airport, they pick me up and then they drop me off again. I don't have to spend a dime because food, lodging, transportation, gas, all that kind of stuff is all included. The only thing I spent extra was I gave a gratuity to some of the staff members in the camps and also to Solomon, my guide. But other than that, everything else was all included. Just going back to Solomon for a second too, like once again, when you book your tour company, ask about the guides, ask about their experience, how long they've been doing it, how many tourists have they led. It's really hard. I know it's hard to kind of get a feel of that, but honestly, he really made the trip. And at one point, we actually met up with this other truck, and he was talking to the driver of that truck. And as we drove away, the truck started following us. And Solomon was laughing because he said that the driver of that truck had actually never been in this particular area of the Serengeti before, and he was completely lost. He didn't know where to go. He didn't know where to take the guests. He was just listening on the radio for when people, they announce when they see something, like there's a lion over here, there's an elephant over here, and he was just trying to drive over to where that was. But the poor guy was completely lost and he didn't want to tell the guests. So he decided to follow us around for the day. So obviously, if you don't want to end up with this situation. And it's kind of tough because there's no way to really to qualify the guides in advance. But my suggestion is just try to search online for as many reviews as you can and try to contact some of the people who posted some of the reviews. For me, I was really lucky. Solomon had 25 years experience in this area. I mean, I don't understand how he knew the Serengeti so well. He literally knew this place like the back of his hand. At times, we were coming back to the camp at night, and he knew exactly where to go. And I really don't understand how, because there's no sign markers, there's no landmarks, there's no nothing. It's literally the same thing, grass, occasional tree, some animals, over and over again. So I don't understand how he could orient himself to know exactly which way to go. And not only that, but he had this amazing ability to spot animals well before I could. And don't forget, he's driving at the same time. So he'd be driving along, suddenly stop, roll down the window, look over to his right and say, hey, there's a cheetah over there. And I look, and far off in the distance on a rock, there'd be like a little bump on top of the rock. And he'd be like, that's a cheetah head. And sure enough, I'd zoom in with my camera and it was a cheetah head. And it was just amazing that he was able to spot these things. But also too, is provide a lot of information and commentary on all the animals that we were seeing. I was really interested in seeing all the variety of animals that I saw there, not just the big five, but even some of the birds and the butterflies and all that kind of stuff. And I was really, really impressed that he knew about so many of these animals. So my suggestion is when you're looking for a guide, really try to ask as many detailed questions as you can about who your guide is going to be, what their experience is, how long have they been doing in that area, and then try to find reviews online of that tour company. Next thing I want to talk briefly about the camps. I stayed in three different camps because we did a bit of a road trip. Started in the central Serengeti, went up to the north, and then went over to this area called Lake Natron, and then back to Arusha. So we stayed in three different camps, and like I mentioned, the camps were amazing. Were way better than I thought they would be, and it was just absolutely, once again, a fantastic experience. The staff made it really great. And one particular camp really stood out, which was the Chaka camp. And this is a mobile camp. They operate half the year in the southern Serengeti and half the year in northern Serengeti. And they take everything down and move halfway across the Serengeti there. But this camp was unbelievable. The tent was huge. It was, like I said, as large as my department in Tokyo. Had a full king-size bed, running water, flushing toilets. They had this nice little writing desk inside with a charger and radio if I needed to call the staff there for any reason. And it was just a really, really pleasant experience to stay at the Chaka camp. And every day to go out on Serengeti, come back, they would greet you when you came back with a drink and a cold towel to wipe the dust off your face. So if you're thinking about going on safari, really, really research these camps well, because they can make a huge difference in the enjoyment of your trip. And I'll say one thing about the Lake Natron camp. Lake Natron is this lake that's under a volcano. And if you look online, it kind of, the area kind of looks like the surface of the moon. Literally, there's nothing there. There's dust and volcano rocks and all that. And I wasn't really too thrilled to go to this area. Partially because it was such a dramatic change from my stay at the Chaka camp. Chaka camp was in the middle of Serengeti. So every day I would see interesting and new things. At one point, actually, I walked out of my tent. I saw these lion prints in front of my tent in the dirt in front of me, which was really cool and scary at the same time. But we left there and we drove to Lake Nachon. And I guess Lake Nachon is kind of nice in its own way if you like lunar surfaces and all that, but the camp itself was such a huge letdown from the Chaka camp. The service wasn't as great, the quality of everything wasn't as great, and apparently I found out that the camp I was staying at was the nicest one in that entire area. But had I known, now the thing with Lake Nachon, they advertise themselves on their website as a luxury camp, but my feeling is it's not a luxury camp, it's actually an eco camp. So they don't have flushing toilets. They got these composting toilets, and they don't have a lot of facilities that the Chaka camp had. And so my feeling with them is luxury is a rather generous word for them. I would really consider them more of an eco camp. So if you're into that, you'll have no problems there. You'll love it. There's this nice little stream that runs in front of the camp. You can walk out on the lake, the dry lake bed. There's supposed to be 2 million flamingos that hang out there. They weren't there when I was there, but I mean, it is kind of neat to see because it just looks so barren and so foreign. But having left this amazing experience at Chaka camp and then come to this Lake Nachon camp with this, you know, eco camp was just a huge letdown for me. And had I known the quality of that camp, I would have told Rob that I could easily skip Lake Nachon. It wasn't a priority for me. So ask your guide that when you're booking your trip. Ask him what are the facilities of the camps and what's there to see, because you may not actually want to visit a certain area and spend more time in another area. For me, I would have gladly spent a couple extra days at Chaka camp and then just skip Lake Nachon altogether. But for you, it might be totally different. I mean, you may absolutely love it. But I wish I had asked him a little bit more about the service level at each camp, because then I would have changed the itinerary a little bit. But once again, I really highly recommend Chaka camp because the staff there were fantastic. I met some really great travelers at that place, a lot of retirees, a lot of families, people who have been traveling quite a bit. So it was fun to sit around the campfire and hear their stories every night. The typical day at the camp was, you know, you wake up fairly early. I tend to wake up early anyways, but you wake up, you know, 7, 8 in the morning or so. It's kind of fun and scary, actually, to listen to the animals out at night. You can hear the hyenas, like, literally right outside your tent. I remember one night I almost fell asleep, and I heard this, like, loud exhale of something, like, literally right outside my tent. It did it, like, a couple of times. So I kind of shook the tent, hoping it scared it away. I don't know what it was, but yeah, like I said before, you step out of your tent, and you see, like, lion prints or hyena prints or things like that. Because the camps are not enclosed. They're literally in the middle of the Serengeti, so animals can come and go. But every day I would wake up around 7, 8 and head out to have breakfast. And then after that, we would head out on the Serengeti to do what they call a game drive. And I had two choices. I could either go out in the morning, come back to camp and have breakfast or lunch at camp, or I could just keep going and stay out all day. And I chose to stay out all day because usually you're quite a ways away from the camp. You may be a couple hour drive away from the camp. So I didn't want to spend a couple hours driving back to the camp, eat lunch, and then a couple hours going back out. So I opted for lunch bag option, and I much prefer that because this allowed us the whole day to go wherever we wanted. We could eat wherever we wanted and gave us the most flexibility. So we would go out all day and usually come back around 3, 4, or 5 o'clock. I'd wash up and then have dinner around 7, 7:30, and then lights out usually around 9 o'clock, and I just go to sleep. There's nothing else to do. There's no internet there. There's no TV. They call the fireplace Bush TV, which I thought was kind of funny, but yeah, you go to sleep and then wake up and do it all the next day. So that was kind of the schedule around the camp. And like I said, like meeting all the other travelers at the camp was really great. People from all around the world. And then everybody would go out during the day and then come back and tell stories about who saw what. And, you know, some people saw something that you really wanted to see and all that kind of stuff. So it was really, really lots of fun to talk with the other travelers there and kind of share stories of what everyone had seen that day. The other thing I want to mention too, kind of at the camp, actually the first camp that I stayed at, we really had, what is this called? Pumzi Zika Classic Camp. And I'll link to all these in the article. But the thing that struck me the most about this camp was the first camp I stayed at, and it wasn't bad. It wasn't the same quality as Chaka Camp, but it was much better than Lake Natron. It's kind of like the mid-range camp. But the thing that struck me the most about my night at this first camp, Pum Zika Classic Camp, was the unbelievable amount of stars that I saw in the sky. And having lived in cities most of my life, and in Tokyo, which is a city that's lit up all the time, I was just astonished at the sheer number of stars that I saw. I mean, it's just like literally like a blanket of stars, because there's no light there. I mean, the camps are at night and there's no light. They got these lanterns that kind of lit that they light outside your tent, but other than that, there's no light. So you get this really clear view of the stars. And then my guide, like I said, this guy's like a Wikipedia of Africa, because he walks over with his laser pointer and starts pointing out all the different stars and constellations in the sky. I think we saw like Venus, like Jupiter. We could see like the North Star and all these different constellations. And at one point, we could even see the Milky Way. It was just amazing to be able to look up and see the Milky Way. It really kind of gives you this perspective, like, wow, we're really tiny here, and there could be a lot of other people out there. I tried to take some time-lapse photography of it, but my photography skills didn't work. Everything came out blurry, so I was really disappointed in that. I'm gonna have to work on my night sky photography skills. But if you like astronomy, if you're into that, if you're way more knowledgeable about it than I am, I mean, go to Africa and wait till night and just look up. It's just amazing the sheer number of stars that you see. And the thing that's kind of interesting too, actually, is the fact that what you're seeing is not even as good as what the astronauts see. I've heard that the astronauts, they get to see just absolute clarity because we're looking through the atmosphere, which kind of gives everything a bit of a fuzzy look. But when you're obviously floating around in space, you have an unlimited view. So kind of jealous of what they got to see. But I was so glad that I got to experience that, because I never ever see anything like that in the city. So if you're into astronomy and that kind of thing, another great reason to go to Africa. Speaking of photography, let me talk a little bit about the camera gear and stuff like that. I'm not a professional photographer at all. I consider myself an amateur photographer. Every time I go on a trip somewhere and I gotta take a bunch of photos, I usually watch a bunch of YouTube videos to kind of learn how to shoot better photos. And this was no exception, because I've never shot wildlife before. Typically the stuff that I shoot is more urban. You know, places like go in Europe is more street. So I never shot wildlife before, and I never shot with a long lens before. I rented a 100 to 400 millimeter lens here in Tokyo, and I took that with me, and I never shot with anything that long before. So I watched a bunch of videos on YouTube, because I didn't want to go to Africa and come away with a bunch of bad photos, because, you know, it's not like I can tell the animal, hey, wait, hold on there, do that again, or I just go back next week. So this is really a once in a lifetime opportunity. I wanted to try to make sure that I get as many great photos as I can. So I watched a bunch of YouTube videos and then went out there, and it was actually really great. Once again, my guide was fantastic, because my guide has all this experience working with other better photographers than I am. He even's worked with the BBC film crew, so he understands what the photographer is looking for. He understands how to position the car. He understands, it was interesting too, is he understands how the animals are going to move. So he would tell us, hey, let's drive over there, because the animal is going to move from here to here. You can get a head-on shot instead of all these shots of the animals walking away all the time. So he was really great in helping me set up the shots. A couple of things to kind of think about, if you're going on safari and you're not an experienced photographer, and you want to really get great shots, is that, I mean, obviously you have to rent a long lens. I rented a 100 to 400 millimeter lens. To be honest, I would have preferred something a little bit longer, maybe closer to 600 millimeters, because one thing that kind of surprised me a little bit is not most of the animals, I say actually most of the animals, we're not that close to the car. You know how if you go on YouTube, you see all these videos of like lions or cheetahs or whatever sitting on top of the truck, or elephants coming right up to the truck. And yeah, that does happen in certain parts of the Serengeti, and even the area that I had, it happened a couple of times. But for the most part, the animals are quite some distance away from us, and the guides are not really allowed to go off the road path. So it's not like they can just drive over. And the reason why those National Geographic shots look so great is they actually have special permits to go off-road. So when they see a kill or they see an animal that they want to shoot, they can just drive right over to it, get the shot, and then come back on the road. Whereas the regular guides, my guide's not allowed to do that. So a lot of the animals were much further than I thought. I would have preferred to have maybe something a little bit longer, but then again, that would have involved carrying a much larger lens. So I was actually pretty happy with my 100, 400 millimeter. And the other thing too is that the trucks are not really large, and you're kind of moving around a lot in the truck. I was really lucky. I'm really glad I went as a solo traveler on this trip because I had the whole back area to myself. I could go anywhere. They pop the roof up. I could, you know, sit in any seat I want, roll down the windows, shoot out anywhere. But if you're with a family or you're with a couple or there's other, you're in a group, you're kind of limited as to how much you can move around the truck. So carrying a tripod with you will be difficult, and it'd be challenging to set that up for every shot. But these many of the tour companies will offer you a beanbag, and that was really great. So I could put the beanbag down, rest my camera on it, and then get a nice steady shot. And I even saw some travelers. This one lady, she had this huge 600 millimeter lens, and she had this like steady mount thingy mounted to the glass. And I don't know what it was, but I want one because she could mount this thing on the glass, and then she could just get a really nice steady shot. So if you're bringing a long lens, if you've never used a long lens before, because the thing with a long lens is when you're zoomed all the way in, any little movement in the van, in the truck, or with your hand, it gets magnified a lot at the end of the lens. So if you're zoomed in and you move a little bit, your photo is going to be blurry. So you really want everything absolutely dead still, and hand holding it, you're not going to be able to get a sharp shot. So you're going to rest that on the beanbag and then get your shot that way. So ask the tour company, do they have that? Do they have beanbags? And if they are a company that specializes in photography tours, chances are they might have some kind of steady camera or gimbal system that you can hook your camera up to. Another suggestion is to bring more batteries than you think you'll need. And I'm actually really glad that I did this because normally when I travel, I usually have main battery, backup battery. I usually carry just two batteries. But on this recent trip, I bought a new camera. I bought a Panasonic G85. And the reason why I bought this Panasonic is that it has this advanced stabilization system, whereas the camera has stabilization and the lens has stabilization. So they work together, so you get a really, really steady shot, even if you're hand-holding it. But this stabilization really draws on the battery. So I decided, okay, well, I'm going to take four batteries just in case. I didn't think I would need it, but I'm going to take it just in case. And I'm so glad I took that because I was going through at least three batteries every single time we went out on a game drive. And it's just because that stabilization is working so much harder just to keep the camera still because you're using this long lens. So definitely bring more batteries and more memory cards than you'll think you'll need. And actually, if you're thinking about shooting some video, if you're professional, then you probably already know this, but if you're kind of amateur like me and you're thinking about shooting some video, I actually recommend bringing a second camera for video. Because one thing I found was I only brought one camera and I was kind of switching back between stills and video, and I was using the 100 to 400 millimeter lens, but then if suddenly we came across like a lion or something and they walked up to the truck, I had to switch lenses to get that shot because obviously the 400 is too long. So that was a bit of a pain in the ass to have to switch back and forth. On hindsight, what I wish I'd done was I actually wish I'd taken a second body or even a second camera, maybe a cheaper camera. I was thinking maybe like the Canon M5 or whatever they're called, those kind of things, and just use that for close-ups and shooting video. That way I didn't have to change lenses as much. And you really don't want to be changing lenses a lot when you're out on a safari because there is dust everywhere. If you look on my website, I got a photo of my camera just absolutely covered in dust. Thank God that the Panasonic is dust-proof and weather-sealed, they say. So we'll find out how good it is. But there's dust everywhere. So you don't want to be changing your lenses a lot. So if you're thinking about shooting some video, and you can afford it, definitely think about bringing two cameras. You will not, put it this way, you'll not regret it if you do. Even if you're an amateur photographer, amateur videographer, you will love having the option of having a closer camera and then a zoom camera as well. One of the things too, is I mentioned that in the trucks, a lot of the trucks I noticed had like electrical outlet. My truck had that too. So I actually bought this charger from Amazon. And so what I would do is I would charge the batteries as they ran out while I was using another one. So you can charge in the truck, which is great, but I found the charge a little bit slow. And so just bring extra batteries because you absolutely do not want to run out when you're out in the Serengeti. And the last tip that I want to mention that I saw this on a YouTube video and it really, really helped a lot was that all the trucks have a pop-up roof. So you can stand in the truck and you got this pop-up roof. You can shoot down on the animals and you get this like 360 view around the truck. But the issue with that is all your shots then kind of look the same. You're always looking down on the animal. It makes the animal kind of look smaller. And you don't want all your shots look like that. Now, my guide wouldn't let me out of the truck. When the animals are there, they don't let you out of the truck for obvious reasons. But as a photographer, come on, you know, you want to get out of the truck sometime and get a little closer. But they won't let you to do that. So this tip that I saw on YouTube, which was great, is many DSLRs now have that articulating screen. So the back screen pops out. You can kind of twist it around. So what this photographer recommended is you roll down the window, lean yourself out the window, put the camera as low as you can, and use the articulating screen to compose your shot. And I did this, and I managed to get some really great shots at eye level of some of the lions lying in the grass on the Serengeti. And so I'm really happy I saw that video. If you go on the website, anthonyjoe.com/Tanzania, you'll see the photos I have of these lions just looking directly in the camera. It literally looks like I'm right in front of them, but we're actually like 20, 30 feet away, and I'm just leaned out the truck. So that was a great tip. I'm really glad I got that, and I hope you get a really great photo as well. One thing I want to say about the animals is there's a term that I heard a lot called the Big Five. And the Big Five is a term that was used by big game hunters a long time ago as referring to the five most difficult animals in Africa to hunt on foot. And they are lion, elephant, buffalo, leopard, and rhinoceros. And so I guess if you're a big game hunter and you shot the Big Five, congratulations. Yeah, like big deal. But anyway, so I guess now it's kind of used more of a term for travelers to shoot photos or see the Big Five. Speaking of hunting, I can understand the attraction of a hunter to go to these kind of places because it is, as a photographer, it is kind of also exciting to be able to kind of stalk this animal and then get the perfect shot, get the perfect photo. For the hunter, I guess it's the same thing. You just end up shooting the animal. But I challenge all you hunters to change your strategy because when I was out on the Serengeti, I really didn't see the skill involved in shooting one of these animals. Because, for example, you see these photos online of like the hunters with the lion and it looks all ferocious and all that. But the reality is, if you look at all these animals, many of them are just lying there doing nothing. You know, the videos you see online of like lions chasing an animal and killing it and all that, that actually doesn't happen very often because it's kind of hot and the lions don't really want to do much and they sleep 18 hours a day. So most of the time I saw the lions and the big cats just lying there sleeping. And so I didn't understand what the draw is because as a hunter, you could literally drive up to this thing, shoot it in the head and it'd big deal. So I guess you get your cool Instagram photo and you can tell stories that, you stalked this thing and you harvested it or whatever. But the reality is, like, think about your pet cat at home. Like, stalk your pet cat at home. How hard is that? They're just lying there. You can walk up to it and nothing. So my challenge for you hunters is put down your gun and pick up a pair of tweezers. Because if you can go up to this lion, giraffe, elephant, leopard, whatever, and pluck a hair out of its tail and then get back to your car, that is seriously impressive. Because it's kind of tempting, to be honest, because you're literally like feet away from this lion or cheetah or whatever, and you kind of want to get out and pet it. But of course you can't. It's just lying there. It's interesting how actually all the animals completely ignore the trucks. I guess they're so used to seeing the trucks there, they just completely and utterly ignore them. So if you're a hunter, I would be more impressed if I came to your house and saw your framed photos of like hair from a lion, hair from a giraffe, hair from an elephant, instead of all the heads that you got mounted on your wall. If you can do that, props to you. Yeah, so the Big Five is something that a lot of travelers I heard talk about, but don't focus on only the Big Five. I was so impressed and amazed with just all the animals that I saw there, even like butterflies I saw, like just had these amazing colors I'd never seen before. There's this bird. What's the name of this bird? This bird's called a greater blue-eared starling. And this bird is just the most striking color of blue I've ever seen in my life. It's just like this crazy bright blue. And I'd see it flying around everywhere. And it was just such a fantastic bird to see. I really enjoyed seeing the vultures. The vultures reminded me of the fell beast from Lord of the Rings. You know, the fell beasts were those dragon-like things that were ridden by the Nazgul. I mean, the vultures, they look so cool. They're way bigger than I thought. It was massive wingspan. They spiral around in the sky looking for corpses and dead animals to eat. They come down and they start chewing on these things. I thought they were kind of ugly looking originally, but when you actually look at them up close, they have this kind of weird Dracula-like elegance to them, but they're kind of all over the place. They're really, really fun to see. And just all the other animals that were there that weren't the big five, I found utterly fascinating to see. For example, did you know that zebras have like a really, really round stomach? Like their whole midsection is like a barrel. I mean, I always kind of thought the zebras were like horses and were quite slim, but they're kind of actually funny looking. You almost feel like you could like tip them over and they'd like roll down the hill because they have this like super round midsection and these little stick legs sticking out. And my guy told me that it's due to the diet that they eat, it forms a lot of gas inside of them or something like that. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, just one of those small things that I found utterly fascinating that I had literally no idea about before I went there. And then my favorite animal actually to see in the Serengeti was the Thompson gazelle. You've probably seen nature videos of gazelles being hunted by cheetahs or whatnot. And so my impression of the gazelle was I always thought that they were quite large, about the size of a North American deer. That was kind of in my head what they were, because obviously on video you don't have any perspective of how big they are, but it turns out actually gazelles are much smaller than that. They're about the size of a large dog, and they're just as playful. They're really fun. They're all over the place. They're all over the Serengeti. They have this gorgeous kind of brown colored coat with these really nice looking curled horns. They have like these ringed curled horns. I don't know how you call it, but they're everywhere. And they're one of the few animals that would actually acknowledge you. Like I said before, most of the animals, I was really surprised, paid absolutely no attention to you in the truck at all. You know, in Canada, I mean, when you start a car, if there's an animal nearby, the noise will spook it and it'll run away. But here in the Serengeti, I was astonished that there'd be like 15 trucks, you know, around this elephant or around this lion or whatever. And these are all diesel trucks, so they're all clattering away. And the animal just didn't care at all. They were just, and they don't acknowledge you at all. But the gazelles would, I guess because they're kind of a prey animal, they have to kind of be aware of what's going on. But so as you're driving down the road, you come across a bunch of gazelles, they kind of run away, but they kind of stop, they turn around, they look at you. And literally, they're like a dog, you just want to get out and play with the thing. So they were super fun. So I highly recommend if you're going on safari, yeah, the big five are great to see, but I mean, it was just such a wide range of animals that we saw there. And once again, my guide was unbelievable in his knowledge of everything that we saw. Of the birds, he knew all about the birds and all the different animals, their habits and all that kind of stuff. So I absolutely enjoyed every aspect of it. Seeing the elephants, seeing lions, seeing cheetahs and all that. Yeah, of course, that was amazing. But also, like I said, seeing like these tiny butterflies was great. There was this one lizard, they call it the Spider-Man lizard, lizard, because it has red and blue coloring on it. It's kind of cool, so they call it the Spider-Man lizard. We even saw a cobra at one point, and I was trying to film it, and then my guide tells me, like, oh, by the way, don't get too close, because that's actually a spitting cobra. It can spit venom like 6 feet, you know, aim it at your eye. So I was like, oh, okay, rolled up the window there. But it was just overall, it's just the sheer number of wildlife and all that we saw was unbelievable. However, I want to say something else too about the wildlife is that fact that when you watch my video on my website or you see other people's videos, what you're seeing is the highlights. And I kind of thought that's what the whole experience would be like. I thought it'd be animals literally everywhere and we'd be like swimming in them. But the truth is, it's a wild park. Obviously, the animals are wild. They can do whatever the hell they want. And there can be long periods of time where you don't actually see anything. And to be honest, I actually enjoyed this too, because like I said, coming from Tokyo, where there's buildings and people every single place you go, being in the middle of the Serengeti and there's literally nothing around you, nothing, no animals, nothing, just grass and that's it. Maybe a tree off in the distance and that's it. I actually really enjoyed that. But be prepared that, for example, if you have kids, they might think that, you know, it's going to be like National Geographic, whereas you could end up driving around for a long time and not actually see anything. And, you know, that happened to us actually when we were following the wildebeest. So part of the reason why I went to the northern Serengeti was to see the crossing of the wildebeest. Now, I'm sure you've seen these videos online where the wildebeest will cross. They migrate from the south to the north following the grass, I guess, and they have to cross a bunch of rivers. And in these rivers are these crocodiles who are obviously waiting for one of the wildebeest to slip, and then the crocodile has lunch. So we went out one day to kind of follow the wildebeest along the, I think it's called the Mara River, this river, and to see where they would cross. And we spent pretty much the whole day just following the wildebeest. And this is another reason why I'm so glad that I booked a private tour, is because my guide asked me, do you want to spend the day following them? And at times we would literally sit on one side of the river and the wildebeest on the other side and just sit for a couple hours and waiting to see what they would do. And he would ask me, you know, do you want to drive around? Do you want to see other animals? Do you want to sit here and wait? And I was happy to wait. But if I was in a group tour, I wouldn't have had that option. You know, the group tour, they have a set itinerary and they have to kind of keep to that. So I'm really glad that I booked a private tour, because I told them, I said, hey, I'm chill out here. Let's wait. And the thing with the wildebeest is that they go up the river, and I mean, who knows why they decide to cross? Who knows why they pick a certain point to cross? But you have to have a lot of patience and a really good guide to see the crossing of the wildebeest. Because there were other travelers that I talked to, been there for a couple of days, and they hadn't seen anything. They'd seen the wildebeest come to the river bank a few times and dip their hoof in the water, but then change their mind and go back up. So if you look at the video on my website, you'll see, like, I was really lucky and I got to see this massive crossing of like thousands of wildebeest all at once. But that only came about because my guide and I had the patience to follow them. And I think we literally followed them like 4 or 5 hours up the river. And they're just walking along the river, and they would just every now and then come down. They decide, nah, I don't want to cross here, and they just keep going. And then suddenly at one point, a few started to cross. And then as soon as a few started, it became this massive stampede. And then they all started to cross all at once. And it was interesting because it was over really fast. I was kind of surprised actually how fast it was over. They all cross at once. They all come to their side. And then they all just start eating again. And it's kind of funny to see in a way, because it's quite obviously traumatic for some of them. You kind of see a few that didn't make it. They're kind of floating in the water there. But the rest of them just like, okay, I just about died. Now I'm going to eat some more grass. So if you're going to see the crossing of the wildebeest, have patience. If you're going to go see any animal there, you got to have patience. You got to just appreciate the fact that you're in Africa and, you know, you're on their time. You're on the animal's time, basically. And so there's nothing you can do about it. Just relax and enjoy it. Going on this trip was more incredible and amazing than I ever could have imagined. I won't say it was life-changing, because that sounds a bit cliche, but it was definitely perspective-changing. It made me realize that, one, I really shouldn't think of Africa as one giant country. I mean, Tanzania is his own separate country. It actually, at one point, it was kind of interesting that we were on the border of Kenya and Tanzania, and I mean, there's literally no border there. There's a stone in the ground that has a T and a K on it, and that's the border. But my guides spotted guides from Kenya in the Tanzania side. And so they're really upset about it. They're like, oh, this guy shouldn't be here. You know, this is our country. Get the hell out of here, kind of thing. But it really goes to show you that each country in Africa is unique and different. And I really shouldn't lump everything together. That was something that I really learned. I also learned, too, just the sheer number of animals that I saw. And I really